Welcome to In the Weeds with Nicole Asquith, exploring the way culture shapes our relationship to the natural world. It's the thick of summer, a good time to think about our sensuous relationship with the natural world. Today is part two of an episode I recorded earlier in the year, in which I discussed David Abrams' book, The Spell of the Sensuous, with Trevian Stanger, instructor of environmental studies and science at St. Michael's College in Vermont. When we discussed the book the first time, we realized that there was so much to talk about that we only made it about a third of the way into the book. If you haven't listened to that episode yet, you might want to do so, though you can also listen to this one on its own. Another one that relates to this discussion of Abrams' book is the episode with Johanna Drucker about the invention of the alphabet. As you'll hear, a central part of Abrams' argument focuses on this pivotal moment in human history. I'll put links to both of these episodes in the show notes in case you'd like to return to them, either before or after listening to this one. Before we begin, a disclaimer. There were some technical issues with this recording, which you'll hear in the earlier part of Trevian's audio. I hope you'll overlook the little bumps and blemishes, because I found this to be one of the most meaningful interviews I've recorded. One of my teenage son's favorite comebacks these days is, "It's not that deep, Mom." In this case, it is that deep. So let's start with a central part of his argument in this book, which I think is one of the things that this book is famous for, and that is his argument about the alphabet, about the invention of the alphabet. So he says a couple of times in the book that there are a number of things that people have blamed for where we are with respect to the natural world, our alienation from the natural world and the destruction that we have wrought. But he says, I'm going to focus in particular on the invention of the alphabet. He gives a history. He gives his version of the history of writing, and he starts with what he sees as prefiguring writing, which is reading signs in the natural world. An example that he cites is reading tracks of other animals on the forest floor as a hunter or as somebody who is trying to avoid encounters with predators and so on. So let's just start with that. Why do you think that that's an important precedent for writing for Abram, and do you find that convincing?
Yes. Well, certainly, even before trying to operationalize it into the larger argument, just to make a connection that to look closely at tracks, especially those places where you might find a multitude of tracks, say the mud along a small creek or on tidal flats, it sure does look a lot like script. It sure does look a lot like lots of letters. So the fact that what we came up with as letters was almost an early biomimicry of sorts, I think just a wonderful thing to posit and to recognize to be the case. And then the fact that not only are they these cool looking marks made by creatures, that they then can tell a story. They very much resemble a text. You could tell the direction of an animal, what animal came through when, how they were moving. Very good trackers can tell were they running, were they loping, were they grazing, were they scavenging. You might even see a story written in the tracks, or as I found this winter, written in the snow of, I found the story of weasel's last walk through my field.
Oh, that's lovely.
Yeah, because it was a story that had the end of a book. It had the end of big owl wing imprint and a spot of blood and no more weasel tracks. The fact that pre-literate, long before alphabet and text, that we were out in the world using our eyes to read the, what is effectively the letters and words of the animals around us. I think it's a lovely thing he's pointing out, that it shares that old ancestry. Mm. We didn't come up with some crazy, strange way of writing. It's actually a pretty basic, our version of like, hey, could I make a track, but with my finger on purpose rather than just my foot tracks? Could I draw a track? So it's nice. I think he does this a lot, right? Like, let's notice almost all of our, even our fanciest stuff probably can be traced back to our Paleolithic ways of being in a pre-technological world.
Yeah. Let's notice what is there. Yeah, it also makes me think about how, for me personally, I mean, I certainly don't have the skills of a tracker, but I feel like, you know, I did grow up in this alphabetic world, right? In a world of, and was a kid who read a lot. And I feel like it's later in life that I am trying to learn how to read the natural world. If the story of human history starts from there, I feel like nowadays it kind of goes in reverse sometimes, because that's a knowledge that most of us don't have, right?
Right. Yeah. We bypass it, and we're often in almost a rush to teach children these letters. I should, real quick, since it's in front of me, more eloquent than I was just trying to say, he says, "Our first writing clearly was our own tracks, our footprints, our handprints in mud or ash pressed upon the rock. Later, perhaps, we found that by copying the distinctive prints and scratches made by other animals, we could gain a new power. Here was a method of identifying with the other animal, taking on its expressive magic in order to learn of its whereabouts, to draw near, to make it appear. Tracing the impression left by a deer's body in the snow, or transferring the outline onto the wall of the cave, these were ways of placing oneself in distant contact with the other, whether to invoke its influence or to exert one's own." All the earliest signs we have of what we might call the invention of writing, or the invention of us drawing, tended to be this, right? Us drawing animals or drawing symbols, almost always mimicking or trying to somehow set down something about the animals that we live amongst.
Right. Yeah, I like listening to you read that. The word identifying jumped out at me. And also this sense of contact, you know, almost that the sign is almost like a physical contact of some sort, that there's an intimacy, a relationship through those early signs. And yeah, that's the next step that he talks about, is these pictorial systems of writing. Today, we still have the Chinese writing system, but older ones too. So he talks about, for instance, the petroglyphs of pre-Columbian North America. And he says they abound with images of prey animals, of rain clouds and lightning, of eagle, snake, and so on. So in those early writing systems, he, as the part that you read demonstrates, he still sees it as anchored in our sensorial engagement with the natural world and this sense of relationship, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that each, even once something like an alphabet starts to come on, like we still have in Chinese texts, that it's pictographs. So a letter is still a picture of something, that it refers to something out there.
Right.
Like, so you might have a word that is the combination of a sign for mountain and a sign for rain. If you were to learn Chinese, I remember the few times I've had Chinese students show me what certain letters are, and they learn them because sometimes it is two different symbols sort of layered on top of each other. And those two are both pictures about something out in the landscape. Of course, that was easier when all you were describing generally was things in the landscape. You weren't trying to describe HTML coding.
Right. It gets more and more abstract by the day, right? In some ways, although in some ways I wonder if the new technologies, and we can talk about that, makes language move faster and therefore be less abstract in some ways too.
Yeah, it could still be pointing somewhere. Yeah, is there more? I've got a few other things we could say about the idea of the pictograph. And then what's another one? Ideograms and rebuses.
Rebuses. So rebuses are like puns, basically. So it's when you take a pictograph and you use it for the sound rather than for the representation. So the example that he gives is, for belief, you could have a pictograph of a bee and a pictograph of a leaf. And so it would represent the sounds. So it's kind of like a visual pun. And early cuneiform used those, Egyptian hieroglyphics used those as well.
Yeah, right. That is fun. Reminds me, I feel like there were some game shows around when we were kids of essentially needing to solve puzzles of putting those things together.
Yeah, the playfulness of language, yeah, is an important dimension for sure. Yeah. Well, what were your other thoughts about the pictographic? I'm curious.
So one thing it got me thinking about was pictographics on a certain level, really, they make sense because they point to something, they refer to something out in the world around us. So you're trying to teach a child to read, they figure out pictures pretty quickly.
Right.
Like they learn animals super fast, not from even seeing them in real life, but from pictures of animals. So when a lot of the demands on language had to do with what animals we eat and track, what plants we eat and tend, when language carried a load of sort of a ecological function, pictographs were wonderful and made a lot of sense, I'm sure. A big shift in current writing in the alphabet as we now know it is that the letters don't mean anything
right.
on their own. They don't point to anything in the landscape. And I remember kind of realizing this pretty full on, helping my 5-year-old daughter start learning letters over the last couple of years. Each one is really just this. Yes, we can track specific letters, maybe have a long history behind them, but others, you know, from a kid's perspective, they don't mean anything, right? They are just arbitrary shapes of a particular configuration. There's nothing inherently R about the R. It would just be luck if there was some animal that had R-ness, if Raven had an R shape in its claws or something, but it's not out there. So each letter for a kid really needs to be learned in total isolation from their lived experience out in the world. They're hard to learn for that reason. They are one of the first times where I think we begin this process that I think he's homing in on too, where the alphabet is independent of the sensuous world around us.
Yeah, well, have you heard about this recent controversy about how kids are taught to read? I just was hearing the podcast for the New York Times did an episode on it recently, which I found interesting. So there are these basically two schools of thought about how to teach children how to read. And one that has been current for a while is based on this idea that children learn through curiosity. And so if they are exposed to books, that's the best way to teach them how to read. And so this led to books where you would have a lot of images, you know, pictorial representation. So the example that's given is like you would have the word yellow and then the color yellow. But the problem is that it's really an arbitrary relationship, right? Because really the way the kids learn how to read is through phonetics, because what letters actually represent are human sounds, right? And so I just thought it was interesting that there's controversy, and it's led to the realization that a lot of children who have been taught in this one way have had trouble learning how to read, particularly dyslexic children. And it sort of underscores the fact that reading is not a natural thing to learn how to do, right? It's not, it has to be taught, because it's not something that's sort of like learning how to walk, for instance, you know, it's not something that children are naturally going to do. Anyway, I just thought that was kind of an interesting thing to have, you know, to learn about at the same time that I was delving into the Abram.
Right, right. Well, and that's all made even more clear because we don't have pictographs.
Right.
Because these letters don't come with any pointing toward the outside world. They only point toward themselves. So you have to learn each one independently. And that just clearly makes it harder. It would be easier if you knew that the sign for oak was a combination of acorn and board. If you knew, you know, for each of these words, if it was actually a combination of pictures, kids would figure it out pretty quickly. But instead, because they are sort of their own thing.
Yeah. It
gets us on this split between there's learning the tracks, learning the things of the world that a child walks through, there's sort of a degree of, okay, tune all that out and now just focus on this right here on the page. Don't pay attention to that cup, the bird in the window, to the faucet running. Only look at these letters.
Yeah.
So it's a different activity.
Well, yeah. Well, Abram talks about how reading is its own kind of magic, right? One of the things he points to is the word spell. And the fact that it has this dual meaning in English, you know, to spell, to put letters together in the correct order, but also as in to cast a spell. And for him, this is not just a coincidental, you know.
Right.
The flip side of the difficulty of the alphabet is what it facilitates, right? And we're seeing this now with computers when you have 26 letters that you can use to compose any word in the English language. It allows this facility. It allows, you know, the printing press allows to print books easily. And now with computer languages, similarly, it gives this incredible fluency and facility and this ability to propagate meaning through this human technology, really, that as you say, is sort of separated from this direct relationship to the world. It kind of allows it to just really take off.
Yeah, and in this passage, again, doubling back a little bit, but so that we don't miss it, there's a concerted shift of attention away from any outward or worldly reference of the pictorial image. So when we're dealing with these letters, it's away from that, away from the sensible phenomenon that had previously called forth the spoken utterance, to the shape of the utterance itself, now invoked directly by the written character. A direct association is established between the pictorial sign and the vocal gesture, for the first time completely bypassing the thing pictured. The evocative phenomena, the entities imagined, are no longer a necessary part of the equation. Human utterances are now elicited directly by human main sides. The larger, more than human world is no longer a part of the semiotic, no longer a necessary part of the system.
I think that that's important. And so then you have this primacy of the human, right? So when he talks about human-made signs take primacy over the more than human world. And so he sees this also as a shift towards self-reflexive, self-engaged form of generating meaning and thought for humans. So that's part of it, is that the human-made meaning takes primacy over meaning that can be derived from our interaction with the natural world. I mean, in a way, one of, like, a touchstone for me is in the story of Jane Eyre. I don't know if you ever read it. She's a sort of troubled child, and she retreats in this one scene in particular behind a curtain to read a book. And that was a image that I related to a little bit as a child. And just the act of reading itself, you're sort of folded in on yourself, right? Folded in on this world that is separate from the world around you. And it kind of allows you to close out the world. So in a very literal way, one kind of gets what he means about that, I think.
Yeah, right. Yeah, and if we are combining this with how he links also to, as a culture becomes more written, it also then de-emphasizes the oral. So when more and more of our cultural knowledge is passed from one generation to the next through texts, as opposed to stories, we also start to get a different type of worldview.
Right.
He makes the comparison that just like Plato, deep in philosophy time here, started to think of, there was this ideal, this space not quite here, where concepts lived for all eternity.
Mm-hmm.
Concepts like justice or virtue. And then Abram says, for the letters of the alphabet, like the Platonic ideas, do not exist in the world of ordinary vision.
Right. So what's interesting, so he focuses on the Greek philosophies, and of course, Abram himself is a philosopher. And so I feel like that's a natural place for him to go. And he's interested in the fact that the emergence of this writing system kind of corresponds with the time that Plato is writing down his philosophy. And even Plato writes about his teacher, Socrates, and his famous dialogues. And there's even a distinction between Plato, who is more versed in this new form of writing, and Socrates, who is coming more out of an oral tradition of philosophy. So there's this kind of pivot in human thinking that is really represented by these two philosophers. And yeah, it's this movement towards the abstraction of human thought. And so maybe we can talk about some of the examples. So he talks about these notions of justice, for instance, and says that essentially before Plato, these kinds of concepts in philosophy were only talked about in the context of specific situations. So you would tell a story in which somebody behaved in a just way or an unjust way, right? And it was the story and the specific situation which gave meaning to those words. Whereas Plato is interested in abstracting a notion of justice, as if you can speak of justice, and I think we're now relatively comfortable with that idea, having inherited all of this, as being a thing unto itself. And what Abram is arguing is that before Plato, that doesn't really make any sense, you know, that you can only think of just actions in the context of specific actions. It's really after Plato and after the alphabet. That's part of what's interesting about his argument, is that he links the two, is that it's partly the alphabet that makes it possible to think in this way of these kinds of abstractions, not only for things like justice, but even for things like table or cloud, that you can now have this idea of, you know, the Platonic table, the Platonic cloud, as it were. So what do you think about that, and the idea that he ties the alphabet to this shift?
Well, again, if the maybe the hard part as the reader and as listeners is all the time we're being asked to think that how do these together contribute to us feeling less enmeshed in an animate world? How is the combination working on us subtly and persistently so that we start to invest more of our attention and energy into the abstract, into the kind of always real but never present, and away from the very real, the very sensuous present? And when those are working in concert, I can totally think we can track the argument that this is where we maybe don't get many chances to hear and feel, literally feel stories about the landscape, because we don't tell them the same way. Once we've become a written culture that talks about these things in the abstract almost all the time, the oral tradition really subsides. There aren't people doing it. So that how to go from those things, and then maybe even this is now sounding abstract because that's where we need examples. But at one point on 120, when he's describing how much oral stories, look, as you said, convey their information with actual instances. The listener was made to think of how the concept or the cultural value is being applied in that circumstance. He's saying the more lively the story, the more vital or stirring the encounters within it, the more readily it will be incorporated. And he sort of highlights incorporated, even that corpse, mm-hmm. So becomes embodied. Oral memorization calls for a lively, dynamic, often violent characters and encounters. If the story carries knowledge about a particular plant or natural element, then that entity often be cast, like all the other characters, in fully animate form, capable of person-like adventures and experiences, susceptible to the kinds of setbacks or difficulties we know from our own lives. In this manner, the character or personality of a medicinal plant will be easily remembered, its poisonous attributes be readily avoided, and the precise steps in its preparation will be evident from the sequence of events and the very legend that one chants while preparing it. So to me, here's an example of the way we say currently might learn about the world, even when we're doing, you know, environmental studies or we're teaching kids science. I just on my way in today, I walked through throngs of high schoolers taking a college class for summer credit. And they've got lab equipment out everywhere, cool beakers and water quality measurement instruments. And all the things that they're learning about, of course, valuable. I'm glad they're doing it. But it's not part of a story. It's not told in ways that maybe feel like they are included in it. It's almost like they're going to read the text of what the water sample tells them. And it can all, I think, in general, continue to feel like an abstract, objective thing outside of us that we're reading and learning about, as opposed to something that we are within and encountering.
Yeah, I'm thinking about that word abstract and the ways in which it makes sense mm-hmm. to me, like I think that by abstract, he doesn't necessarily mean general necessarily, because I mean, you can have oral forms of storytelling, fairy tales come to mind, where you can have, you know, a girl or a boy, you know, where it can feel very general. But I think of the notion of abstraction more as this separation, you know, kind of the way you're describing mm-hmm. these science students. They're studying this natural world, but they're very much separated from it. And of course, the scientific method emphasizes also the separation of us as actors from what we're studying as well. So this like parceling out, this kind of separation, I feel like is a really important part of the distinction that he's trying to make here.
Certainly. And I'll acknowledge the difficulty is, you know, at times we're following arguments that they're so compelling that you always want to try to start applying them right away. It can be hard to sit through long chapters
yeah.
and not want to start making your own conclusions and ideas. But you know, I think we're onto something with it, that a lifetime of reading and learning about the concepts rather than the things themselves can make it harder for us to toggle back to really beholding and feeling like a encounter with the things. Like water, to take that example, this giant concept, quickly all of us might have all manner of little data points, how much there is of the world, how much is fresh, how much is salty. We might picture an image of the water cycle, etc. But what about the actual water of that creek you're sitting beside, or this water in your hand, in the vessel? How do we somehow better behold the real thing in front of us and not see it through our lens of a sort of scrim on our lenses
yeah.
of the abstractions?
Yeah, I mean, in a way, he's just sort of pointing to the absurdity of the fact that we have all this information, and that the information in a way makes it harder for us to have a direct experience of the water itself, mm-hmm. right? That there's something kind of mm-hmm. fundamentally strange about it. Part of what I like about the fact that he emphasizes the alphabet and reading in particular is that, you know, nowadays I feel like, going back to the example of kids, nowadays you feel like you've had a win as a parent if your kid is reading, right? As opposed to like scrolling on their phones or something like that. So for me, and I grew up as a big reader, so for me to have him challenge something that is so embedded in my own cultural experience, I feel like is kind of helpful. And mm-hmm. and he's not saying that writing or reading is bad. We should be clear about that.
He's definitely not. And he's a writer.
It's a lot more complex than that. But he's just pointing out the way that this technology that has existed for so long, that it does really shape our behavior and our culture and our relationship to the world at large. So I wonder if you have any thoughts about how this relates to more contemporary technologies. He kind of alludes to that at a certain point, about how, you know, the internet and cell phones and so on may be removing us even further from our relationship with the natural world. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Yeah, of course, because it's clearly going to be, seems like the challenge being foisted upon us, whether we want it or not. Everything from mental health of teens to our own feeling of time slipping through our fingers and how should that time be experienced. I doubt I'm the only one who realizes they've spent half hour on their phone with nothing good to show for mm-hmm. it and just feeling dismayed. How did that just happen? What was that little, almost like a magic trick put upon me? For me, I think when I combine someone like Abrams' work, just to have anyone successfully point out one's own blind spots, ignorance, however we say some unpleasant thing about that you're missing a lot. Might have mentioned this last time, but a great line in a Gary Snyder essay in the book, The Practice of the Wild. He says, not only do most people not know the plants, most people don't know that they don't know the plants. Mm. And some people might hear or read that challenge and, like other challenges, feel aversion to that, so I won't face it or confront it. On that one in particular, I seem to try to go the other way. I want to lean into it. When I think about if a goal for anyone starts to become I'd like to re-inhabit place. I'd like to recalibrate my senses and restore my attention to the outside world. Part of it certainly seems to include a more diligent, thoughtful accounting of where we put our attention. How much of a day do we attend to what thing? And if the phone continues to take a lot of our attention, even if it were a neutral experience at best, maybe sometimes it's positive, seems like we're learning, it's often somewhat of a net loss in terms of our limited bandwidth and energy throughout a day, that half hour of the phone seems to be somewhat vampire-like, seems to take more energy from us than give us anything. If that is just put down, are we then open to something else?
Mm.
And once that's the case, the idea that being attentive to that which grabs our senses, that which captures our eyes, what sort of sparkles, what shift of a smell or a sound is appealing and we feel attracted to it. I mean, all of these things feel like starting points. And I do feel like there is a sense, and Abrams has written about this elsewhere, that the designers of these phones and talking refrigerators and roaming, grazing robot vacuums, these are all our subtle attempt to reanimate our inside inert worlds. We long for a world that speaks to us. We long for the time when to be awake and alert was to be engaged by the myriad things. And as our indoor worlds have become where most of us spend most of our lives, I think something ridiculous like 90% of American adults' time is spent indoors, that we have a sort of biophilic longing for more animacy. So we're trying to reverse engineer it to happen on the inside, but instead of it being, you know, making all of our houses aviary and filling it with creatures, it's fill it with talking gadgets and fill it with pings and blings and a sense that we want the fridge to know what we want and we want be able to speak aloud and have it mean something. We want to evoke a change in the world around us the way we maybe once did by uttering a prayer or an incantation of gratitude. Now we can say, "Hey, Alexa," and have music come on. And it's all fun to realize it's still not that different. It's still us longing and wanting an animate world, but we're doing it through our tech now.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really compelling argument, I have to say. I wonder if you, as an educator, have thoughts about how the new technology and the other things that we've been talking about might shift our approach to teaching kids. I'll just say, as a parent of a middle schooler and a high schooler, I'm increasingly aware of the ways in which our education system doesn't seem to really speak to the world that we live in. You know, my son, who's a high schooler, and a lot of his friends are aware of the fact that the internet has made knowledge so accessible. The example that my husband gives is imagining my son listening to a teacher lecture about somebody and his internal response being, you know, it's really great that you learned all that stuff. You know, all that stuff. I mean, I can look it up in my phone in about 2 seconds, but, you know, good for you for having learned all that. And so in that sense, like, the technology seems to have rendered some of our traditional learning methods kind of out of touch with reality. And then there's also, like you said, this sort of disconnect with the world at large. I was wondering if, I'm sure you think about this as an educator, and if you have ideas about how our education might speak better to the needs of what children really would like to learn.
Yeah, that's a really fair question. Because I teach in the environmental studies and teach several of the intro courses, including one that opens up what I would say these lines of inquiry. Not only what do we know about the natural world, or often what don't we know, and why don't we tend to know the plants and what trees are good for what anymore. Why don't we know medicine plants? But eventually, you know, we seem to come around with, okay, if we wanted to, we could start up and knowing it, though. Ask ChatGPT, right? The information is there. One can go harvest info at any moment. So it's not just that it's a lack of knowledge. I think most students that I've been able to, you know, track closely, the ones who seem to be engaged, recognize that it's not just a lack of knowledge, it's a lack of connection. A feeling that the natural world, the living world, is almost this island receding away from us. Mm. The more we are afloat just amongst each other, we are feeling kind of lonely and isolated. And the glances back at the living earth are of it burning or of it melting. It on somewhat of a, I think, a recursive view that not only are we somehow damaging this place, we're also losing it. We're like losing a friend, losing something vital about ourselves and how we might have related to each other. And I try to steer us away from just a overly romantic nostalgia and a outright rejection of all things modern or tech, but that the thing we might be longing for would be a feeling like we belong, a feeling like the landscape and the more than human worlds, the actual birds and animals and rivers and the air that we are totally immersed in constantly, that it might answer some of our ennui, some of our apathy, to feel more connected to that again. And once you start on that project, that this could be a rubric, this could be a cleavage point. If it's not helping us feel connected, if it's not helping us feel like we're part of the conversational nature of reality, then maybe don't pursue that one much further. So, like, for example, we have this new birding app that a lot more people are using called Merlin, which I think is really cool. You can identify birds by the sound. It will record a bird song, use deep machine learning of comparing it to millions of other recorded bird calls that eBird through Cornell has compiled over the years. It'll tell you what bird you're hearing. And that is, to me, an exact fork in any road now. We'll continue to be able to identify and know the name of the natural world around us, if you're even deciding to care about that. But then do you just turn it off and then walk away and be like, oh, I know that. But then the next time you hear it, do you now know it? Do you feel any rapport with that bird call or that bird? Do you observe a new thing about where the call is coming from or the weather or what type of environment you're in? Were you in the floodplain last time you heard one, or was that up on the mountain? Oh, they're in both places. Does it engender a more sense of you in the landscape with these creatures? Or is it like you looked up the stats of the 1998 bulls? Like, where does the knowledge bring us in our relationships? That to me, hopefully I let them discover this on their own rather than me just tell them it like I just tried here. That to me is maybe one of these questions of how much does the tech lead toward connection versus just abstraction.
Do you have ways that you try to help your students feel more connected?
I think so. I hope so. I think a project that Abrams is doing here and other writers and thinkers like him is one of starting to feel like even our own minds, the seat of one's experience, one's consciousness, is not itself an alien or a floating thing separate from the landscape. We've had all of these experiences that are somewhat giving us a false sense that we are hidden behind our skulls and we are not in all of this, that nature's out there and we are in here. In the Coda, Abram says, the human mind is not some otherworldly essence that comes to house itself inside our physiology. Rather, it is instilled and provoked by the sensorial field itself, induced by the tensions and participations between the human body and the animate earth. The invisible shapes of smells, rhythms of cricket song, and the movements of shadows are all, in a sense, provide the subtle body of our thoughts. Our own reflections, we might say, are part of the play of light and its reflections. And he quotes Rilke, the inner, what is it, if not intensified sky?
Mm.
But by acknowledging such links between the inner psychological world and the perceptual terrain that surrounds us, we begin to turn inside out, loosening the psyche from its confinement within a strictly human sphere, freeing sentience to return to the sensible world that contains us. Intelligence is no longer ours alone, but a property of the earth. We are in it, immersed in its depths. And each terrain, inside each terrain, each ecology seems to have its own particular intelligence, its unique vernacular of soil and leaf and sky. So to have an invitation that we needn't feel limited to just how we might plug into the marketplace, how we might brand ourselves of what's going to make us successful and, you know, fit into the human culture only, but that you are also, just by being a being, an expression of and participant in the landscape. And then usually, wow, and the landscape's amazing. I guess I'm amazing too. Oh, the landscape's damaged and I can help heal it. That to me just starts a whole series of what I hope are invitations to be part of the place itself, a functioning part of the place itself, as Freeman House says in Totem Salmon. And when we're able to do these things, I think, again, from books, from ideas, ideas plus our senses, what I like is the experience is the invitation. The landscape is the reward. The reward, hopefully, doesn't need other humans to condone it or reward you for it. When we're chasing acceptance and praise from only other people, I think that gets part of our sense of feeling lost or adriftness.
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely. Well, if you could explain that to my teenagers, I would appreciate it.
Yeah, sure. I know. Well, I have the benefit of a captive audience over a couple months and with good authors and sit spots and a pretty lively landscape out the back door. I'm sure it's, I know it's harder and not that clean cut.
Yeah, no, but I mean, I think it's obviously it's very meaningful work, and it's work that we have with ourselves as well. And so it's an ongoing form of engagement. I hope you're having a lovely summer. If you'd like to reach out to me with your thoughts about this episode or anything else related to the podcast, send me an email. The address is askwith, that's askwith, .intheweeds@gmail.com. I'll be back soon with more explorations of the nature-culture nexus. Take care.